Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, November 29th. Yes, a new COVID variant was identified over Thanksgiving weekend and given the name Omicron. The public health analyst said not to panic, but nobody told the financial analysts. The Dow dropped 900 points on Friday before the variant even got its name. The Dow is up a little so far today as cooler heads prevail. There are no identified cases in New York, at least as of when we went on the air. But Governor Kathy Hochul declared a state of emergency that would allow her to order hospital staffing and treatment priorities if necessary. The U.S. and the EU banned most travelers from southern Africa, where the first clusters were identified, but it's already in Europe and probably here. Israel and Morocco have each banned all foreigners from anywhere entering their countries. So let's talk about the science and the policy responses with New York Times science and global health correspondent Apoorva Mandavilli. The wording of the headlines in her two articles this weekend say a lot. Scientists are studying whether Omicron leads to severe illness. And the other one, will the vaccine stop Omicron? Scientists are racing to find out. In other words, there's a lot we don't know, and better that we acknowledge that. Apoorva, we always appreciate when you come on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Always a pleasure.
Omicron is a Greek letter, for people wondering, like Delta. What makes the World Health Organization decide a COVID variant that we don't know the severity of yet is worthy of a Greek letter?
Well, in this case, Omicron has a lot of mutations that make scientists worry. It has about 50 new mutations, and that's many more than we've seen in any other variant. And about 30 of those are on the spike protein, which is the most important protein in the virus, really. And so when scientists see that, and then they see that cases seem to be popping up fairly quickly, that really rings their alarm bells.
Could the mutations make it less threatening rather than more? I saw one reference in one article to that sometimes viruses change over time and mutate toward more weakness.
Absolutely. It's a phenomenon called epistasis, where mutations can work together to make things worse, or they can work together to or work against each other and mitigate some of the effects. And we don't really know yet what these mutations do. We know what some of them do. And in modeling, some of these mutations have popped up as not very good ones to have. But we don't know what they do in combination. And we certainly still don't know what some of the unique mutations that have just popped up will do in this context. So one thing I keep hearing from scientists, as you pointed out, is we just don't know. This is one of those very frustrating moments when we want a lot of answers and we just don't have them.
What do we know about the potential severity? I see the theories so far are as likely to suggest, again, that it might produce less severe disease than Delta as that it might be worse.
Well, so the less severe disease is based on some reports from South Africa saying that the early cases seem to be mild and people don't seem to have some of the trademark symptoms of COVID, like the loss of sense of smell. But, you know, doctors I've spoken to have pointed out that it's actually a little too early to conclude that because the variant really hasn't even been long enough to send people to the hospital. We know that there's usually a delay. You know, people first get infected, and then it's a few weeks later that they may end up in the hospital in big numbers. So we don't know that. And we also have been hearing that a lot of the early cases are in young people who would have mild symptoms anyway. So we don't know if it's mild because it's young people getting them or it's because this variant really does cause just mild illness.
And what about the transmissibility? I saw one doctor on TV say 4 times more transmissible than Delta. And even for all that I've covered COVID, I don't really know what that means. How do they know? And what does that really measure when they say 4 times more transmissible?
So they're measuring something called R-naught, which is really a measure of how many people each infected person can spread the virus to. And we know we learned very quickly with Delta that it was incredibly contagious, much more than Alpha, which was the first variant we worried about. And we could see that it was spreading pretty quickly. You know, the numbers you're hearing now for Omicron are really just estimates. I think it's way too early to say what we know about its transmissibility. It certainly seems to be somewhat transmissible because it has popped up in several countries now. But I don't know that we can really put a firm number on exactly how contagious it is quite yet.
I do want to get to the policy responses here. Different countries are reacting differently to the fact that this was discovered in Southern Africa. Some, like the U.S., are banning travel from there. That takes effect today. Two that I know of, Israel and Morocco, are banning travel from everywhere outside their countries, except, I guess, for citizens of their country returning home. What's the science behind travel bans, if that's not too big a question?
There actually isn't any, so that's a very quick answer. Public health experts are actually really upset about these travel bans because, from what we know, the bans accomplish almost nothing, and they do send economies into a tailspin, as you were mentioning earlier on. And, you know, the number of countries that are starting to ban all foreigners is also rising. Japan has just joined that list that you mentioned, Israel and Morocco. You know, it's not really clear what that does, because if they're still letting citizens in, they're probably still letting some people in. Maybe it slows it down by a very little bit. But in the meantime, the real attention needs to be on testing and contact tracing and making sure that everybody's wearing masks, things that we know actually work, rather than what seem like really these big political gestures that probably don't accomplish anything.
Let me play devil's advocate on that a little bit. Maybe the Morocco and Israel, and did you just say Japan now also banning
yes,
travel from
that's
everywhere?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe it makes sense if we assume the variant is everywhere, not just in South Africa and Botswana and around there. Let's go back to our corners in terms of international travel. The U.S. and Europe, for example, as you know, only lifted travel restrictions against each other recently. Canada just started letting in people from the U.S. again after we had so many infections. So why go scattershot, or why let people just go from place to place to place to place rather than this is one of the forms of isolating the virus?
It would be if Canada had completely shut its borders and had stayed shut, for example. But it didn't. And that's true for almost all of these countries. They may have shut their borders before, but in the past few weeks, there has been record numbers of travel again in the United States and also to other countries. And so if a variant was going to be jumping borders, it's already done that. The fact that we've seen the variant now in Canada and in all of these European countries, including in, you know, some places where there isn't a link to travel to South Africa, tells us that the horse has left the barn.
Let's take a phone call. Marilyn in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Apoorva Mandavilli from the New York Times. Hello, Marilyn.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Okay, my question is about the incredibly low rate of genomic sequencing with COVID all over the world. But in the United States, I believe we're only sequencing 3.6% of cases. That comes from a recent Washington Post article.
Now, when you talk about, just for everybody's context, when you talk about genomic sequencing, that's basically testing a positive COVID sample from a person to see which variant it is, right?
Right. And it's almost never done. So the point is, if we're doing so little genomic sequencing, how do we even know that this particular variant isn't here already? And I should mention that South Africa made the point that they should be lauded for discovering it, because they are doing not a lot, but they're doing enough genomic sequencing that they discovered it. But we don't know where else in the world, including the United States, this variant might be, because we're not genomic sequencing. And what is being done to increase genomic sequencing?
Great question. Thank you very much. So, Apoorva, first of all, to the specific point that she made there near the end, is it possible that this is being seen as originating in Southern Africa because they do more genomic sequencing? They're looking for which variant it is more than we are. Is that a possible reality?
That's actually very likely, in fact, because South African researchers have been really on top of this, not just now, but even earlier. You know, they detected the beta variant quite early also, and they have been sequencing very actively, much more than European countries, because I would point out that the South African countries knew that they had Omicron before the European countries really caught on to it and had not caught it yet in their sequencing. I would also, if I were a betting woman, bet that it's already in the U.S. too, and we have not detected it because, as Marilyn said, we're not really sequencing enough cases here. We did ramp it up quite a bit after last year sort of debacles, but we're still nowhere near where we need to be. And so the fact that we haven't found it doesn't mean anything beyond that we just haven't found it yet. It does not mean it's not here yet.
So if I'm sick and I go to the doctor to get a PCR test, the real nasal swab, you know, collected by a medical professional, what do they do with it? And in what determines whether that gets sequenced for what kind of variant?
In most cases, nothing happens with your test. In fact, you may not even know which variant you have, and your doctor may not even know which variant you have. That's been the case throughout most of this pandemic, and it's been one of the most frustrating things. We do not in this country have a public health infrastructure that makes it easy for us to know which tests are coming up positive, which variant they're testing for, what the prevalence is, none of that. We don't actually have a good system for that. So we are building it up. But at the moment, any samples that you may give to a private lab, you know, any commercial lab or even some hospital labs are not actually making it to the CDC or to any organization that can sequence it.
Bernice in Pleasantville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bernice.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Our daughter lives in London, and we had tried to go last year and obviously weren't able to. We're scheduled to go on December 16th. And with this new variant and now new restrictions being put in place in London, we're wondering if it's advisable to go.
Do you give this kind of advice, Apoorva?
You know, I wish I had a crystal ball. And in fact, I'm supposed to go to India next week to see my parents, whom I have not seen in 2 years,
wow,
and to report on tuberculosis. And I don't know if that's still going to happen. I hope so. But, you know, things are changing day by day. So all we can do is hope for the best.
Right. Well, she's asking a judgment question, I think. Like, maybe India will block you from coming in. But then there's the question of, is it safe for her based on, you know, I guess she'll determine her risk tolerance. But even if the UK lets her come in, I guess people are going to start asking themselves those questions in a new way again.
Yeah, and I think a lot will depend on what we find out about the vaccine. So if the caller is vaccinated and has had a booster dose, probably has very high levels of antibodies and will probably be okay, at least from, you know, getting severe disease or being hospitalized. But again, you know, in a couple of weeks, we'll know more of that. And so she might know that before she actually has to get on a plane. But at the moment, we don't know if it's 100% safe.
Yeah, you just said a couple of weeks. Dr. Fauci and just about everyone else I've seen seem to be saying it'll take 2 weeks to get most of the big questions answered, like the severity and like how effective the vaccines we've already gotten are against it. What 2 weeks? Why can't they look at this variant in a lab against the vaccines, for example, and answer that question?
Well, there are some steps that we just can't skip. So in terms of severity, we have to wait to see what happens with hospitalizations. Who is coming into the hospital? Is it only unvaccinated people? What does the age distribution look like? And we can't really draw those conclusions till we see enough numbers. In terms of the vaccine efficacy, We need to be able to build that particular variant from scratch. So what the researchers are doing is starting with the backbone, and then they have to add all of the mutations that this variant has before they can test it against the vaccines. And that takes time. That process of building the variant in an artificial setting in a lab does take time. It also takes time to grow enough of the virus to test live virus, which can only happen in some very specialized labs. So all of these steps just take time, and we don't really want the scientists to skip those steps because of what we were saying earlier. We don't know how these mutations play together. So we don't want to test a half-baked variant. We want all of the mutations before we look at the results.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, and of course at WNYC.org for those of you who listen via streaming, with Apoorva Mandavilli, New York Times science and global health correspondent, as we talk about the Omicron variant. There is concern I've seen expressed that if the response is to ban people coming in from the region where the first clusters were found, then future variants may not be reported by other countries out of fear that they'll be blacklisted. How does science and policy intersect on that?
There are a lot of people in southern African countries who are very upset about these travel bans because they did stick their necks on the line by saying, you know, we have this new variant, everybody else sit up and take notice. And they feel like they're being punished instead of being rewarded for coming out with this information. You know, southern Africa was already reeling from the lack of, you know, travel tourism dollars. And now to have this travel ban, it really just delivers their economy such a strong blow. And a lot of the scientists that I've been speaking to are also frustrated because on the one hand, they're getting requests from scientists all over the world asking them for the sequence of Omicron, asking them for samples of people who've been infected. And at the same time, people from that country are not allowed to go anywhere. So they feel like it's a real double standard, and there is not really a scientific basis for these travel bans.
And some scientists are saying, I told you so, that in a mostly unvaccinated developing world, new variants were always likely to have the environment to develop. And then, of course, they're blaming the West for hoarding vaccines. We've talked about that on this show many times. Do you think that's scientifically supported?
It is, because there are a lot of people who are immunocompromised in one way or another in some of these places. You know, in Africa, there are a lot of people who are HIV positive or who've had TB or who've had other diseases that really weaken their immune system. And we know now that the variants grow best in people who have weak immune systems. And so we're basically rolling the dice when we leave, you know, millions and millions of people in all of these countries unvaccinated while we get boosters. You know, almost every scientist I was speaking to before the boosters were authorized, including a lot of the advisors to the FDA and the CDC, were saying that for people under 65, boosters are not really warranted. But we haven't really delivered those doses, you know, elsewhere. We've made a lot of promises. You know, the U.S. has said it'll deliver, I think, 1.1 billion doses by 2023. And we haven't really seen, you know, most of those delivered yet. We've seen about 25% maybe. And that's true for other countries that have made commitments too. So, you know, now that we're talking about Omicron, it looks like the boosters may actually give you some benefit. And so I think even more countries will want to just give boosters that can afford them. And these countries may get completely left behind.
There was just an ABC News story I saw from last week about how Africa in particular had largely avoided the big outbreaks that we've seen in this country in Europe, despite its low vaccination rates. Is that something you had looked into at all?
You know, it's one of those mysteries. And we don't know why that's happened. There's a lot of, you know, speculation, a lot of theories about why. But I want to note that those theories also existed for India. And, you know, people were saying that for some reason, India has escaped COVID entirely. And then we saw that really horrific wave this spring. So, you know, I think it could just be a matter of the variants not really fully taking off. We did see Beta make quite a dent in South Africa. So it's not as if it's done nothing. It's just not as been as bad as we thought. But, you know, it's not, it could just be luck so far.
Razak in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Good morning. I think your guest answered my first question. The thing is about why is Africa the only continent that has found this virus being banned? I mean, just this week, we saw this virus in the Netherlands. And another thing about it, if you look at the time of the Ebola time, they banned certain African countries from not coming to U.S. and Europe. So I'm thinking to myself, if COVID-19 was found in Africa, this virus, the way that it's killing the West, if it was killing Africa the same way, probably we wouldn't have the COVID-19 vaccine so fast as we having it right now. If you know what I'm talking about. So I think it's definitely a double standard, not just because it's an African nation, but because it's a black nation, a black continent. And we have European countries that are white that are having this virus, but they're not banned from this virus.
They may not have it in the same concentration. Now, Razak, let me play devil's advocate with you for a sec. A year ago, right, when the U.S. was having, Apoorva will correct me if I've got my numbers wrong, but I think last winter, the U.S. which has 4% of the world's population, was having like 20% of the deaths. And because the outbreak was so bad here, we were doing such a bad job of controlling it. A lot of countries banned travel from here in particular because the cluster more than anywhere was here. And so does it make sense to kind of restrict travel from where the cluster is? And maybe it's not as much of a racial double standard if since what happened with respect to Americans being restricted so much.
Well, you might make a little sense there, but if you look at it right now, this virus just came right now, and nobody knows about this virus. So, I mean, European countries already having this virus. Why are they not banned from coming to the U.S.? Why is this only Africa?
Yes.
The reason why? Because it's called Africa and it's found there. So because they black, to me, yes, they are black and don't have that white privilege like European countries. That's why we are being banned.
Razak, I hear you. Please call us again. Apoorva, anything on that? I mean, yes, South Africa has been doing a lot of sequencing, so they found the clusters. We do know, as Razak said, that it's been found as well, and as we said it at the top of the segment, it's been found in the Netherlands, it's been found in a number of European countries now, UK, elsewhere. Do we know that it's more concentrated in Southern Africa? Do we even know that?
I don't think we know that. I think, you know, some of this might just be what we were talking about in terms of the surveillance. How much are we sequencing? How much do we know about what we actually have within our borders? So I think, you know, it's really a guess at this point, exactly where the variant originated, where it's been circulating, how many cases are there anywhere. I think, you know, Razak makes a good point, but I think some of this is, you know, less maybe just with race than also poverty. You know, as a global health reporter, I write about diseases of the poor quite often, and I think he's right in that if this had been isolated, a disease or a virus that was just in Africa or in Asia, in parts of Asia, we wouldn't be seeing the kind of attention that's being paid to it, even if it was killing just as many people. And that's true for HIV, that's true for TB, that's true for malaria. It's true for tons of other diseases that really only affect those parts of the world. The reason we have all these vaccines is because it affects the Western world.
Apoorva Mandavilli, science and global health correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for so much information.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.